Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for September 8th, 2022, in the ongoing year-long series, History of the Discovery, Discoveries of My Work. And I'll continue this week. I left off. I'm in the midst of talking about the early book series. There's a series of other publications that are not so visible to the general public. And these came in the way of private presentations, some of them at American Geophysical Union meetings. And there are a lot of these. And right now, I don't have all the files with me for all of these because it's all paper files. And so anyway, what I'm going to do is give a somewhat of a summary of these. There's probably a dozen total, but I think you're going to get the idea. Now, some of these were a bit more esoteric on topics like solar physics, the solar wind, magnetospheric physics, and things dealing with the sun, the fact that the fusion of the sun is up in the upper atmosphere. And so these are topics that, you know, the majority of people might not be that interested in hearing all the details. But what I will do here is read off some of these topics. And let me just jump on these. Now, I've already talked about these in the Atlantis to Tesla book. At the end, Electric Highways to the Stars is a video that I put out. This was a talk I gave in the UFO Congress 2004. I was one of the keynote speakers. And then there's another paper called Dynamics of a Small Comet, and I went through the details of that paper. There's another paper. Now, these are listed, actually posted in the back of my Atlantis to Tesla book, so you can read them there. It's called Currents Induced by Foreign Objects in Non-Uniform Plasmas. And so that sounds kind of like a mouthful, so I'll kind of go backwards through this title. When you have a capacitor around a star, and this is caused by an excess current of protons in the proton wind that comes out from the fusion-based object. Basically, what does non-uniform mean? Uniform means that if you drew the field lines, they would be parallel. Non-uniform means that they are radiating outwards, and the electric field gets smaller and smaller as the farther you get away from the sun. And so, but be that as it may, the discharges that occur with this outer nebular cloud that surrounds our solar system and all other stars that are like ours, including galactic nuclei, etc., it's non-uniform. And this is very important when you get into certain types of forces, electrical discharges. It's very different than the uniform case. And so this paper, Currents Induced by Foreign Objects. What's a foreign object? It's something that comes in to our solar system or another star system from beyond, like a comet nucleus or like a large planetary object or whatever. And then the currents induced means the discharge. And what happens? What happens when this discharge occurs? And basically, you get a comet. But the comet is a very complex animal. And so, of course, this is what the heart of my work is, but it's not the only piece of it. The comet is actually one of the phenomena. For example, you see it in the rings of Saturn. You see very clearly the plasma discharge phenomena going on with the sweeper moons, with the spokes in the rings of Saturn, etc., coming and going in a radial manner, spinning around the planet very quickly. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is read off some of the titles from the American Geophysical Union meetings, talks, and now these are in the form of an abstract. So what happens? You have an abstract, and that describes the topic, and then in some cases I would have a poster session, and so the abstract describes the content of my poster in a summary form. Or it might be a talk, it might be, there's various formats that you can present. But one of the better formats to present at is in what they call a poster session. where you create this big poster, and it's usually, I was kind of surprised when I went and I started going to American Geophysical Union meetings back in the 80s, I had these beautiful big posters. And others, the scientists, these are guys at NASA that had resources. I mean, I paid for my stuff all by myself. And I had big, beautiful posters that I created, and I took to the print shop, and I had them printed, and I rolled them up, and would take them to the meeting, and they tell you how big a board you have to pin up your poster session, etc. And the NASA scientists would come with little 8.5 sheets of paper and pin them up, and you couldn't even see them from a distance. You had to come up like 3 inches away to read them. And I thought, wow, these people are not very professional, given the resources that they have to produce posters and things that are much more lively and much better production, just from a production point of view, than what I have. But anyway, I also have some posters that are available. They're on my webpage. I have the various decadal posters. One is the 25-year poster. Then there's the 30-year poster. These are celebrating the time after my presence in Cornell. And then there's another one that is the, you can see these on my webpage. But I'll talk about the abstracts here. So that's the main thing. I want to go into the titles of the abstract, break those down. And the reason I'm doing this is for a paper trail. This is to show that year after year after year after year, I was present at the meetings. I was well known at these meetings. And the beauty of a poster session, what happens is this: you have this big panel, and then you have a table where you set out your materials, etc. And the people come by, so that you have literally everybody there, 20,000 scientists passing by, and you get to talk to them. So it's really very interesting. It's much better than giving a little talk where you have maybe 20 scientists in the room that only are interested in their little teeny corner of the world in terms of science. And so you only communicate with those people, and really not to anybody else. You don't have an opportunity to talk to everybody else because they're all off busy doing their thing. But when people have time off and they're not in their own session, they're walking around the auditorium in the poster hall. It's a big hall where everybody has their posters. And that's where it's rather fun to talk to people, because you get to meet so many different people and in different fields. And that's where I met a lot of graduate students, a lot of students that had just gotten their PhD from foreign countries. And this is where I had some very interesting experiences, because a lot of these students come over here. They have I call them a handler. They're a supervisor. But the NASA people watch these students with like a hawk, you know, to make sure they are getting the proper propaganda, etc., to make sure that they're not straying. And I'll be honest with you, I'm the only person that I ever saw there, you know, that I'm aware of, that really brought in a different message than the standard fare of adding a little bit to what was already the standard fare, etc. That was just the way people are. They're just too nice. And of course, that just proves to me they're non-thinkers. But anyway, let me go into the topics here, and I'll pick these titles apart one by one and talk a little bit about the abstract. Okay, so here's the first one. This is from 2009, so I'm jumping ahead a little bit here. And the title, Non-Uniform Plasma Discharges in Near-Earth Space Environment and Ionosphere to Troposphere Responses. Okay, so let me just pick this title apart a little bit. Once again, I talk about non-uniform plasmas, and that's the key, because a uniform plasma is one in which, if you enter it, you really don't even know you're there, because plasma is rarefied gases with the electrons out of the atoms or molecules. And if it's uniform, if you're inside of it, then you really don't, you don't get a force in any direction because of a cluster of charge. In other words, it's uniform. So a uniform plasma is a pretty disinteresting topic, but that's what everybody talks about. And they talk about, well, what if you had a charge there? What would happen? The Debye shielding, and it's a circle, it's a sphere around the object, etc. And they don't talk about how that charged object got there in the first place, and other things that would be very interesting, but they don't even talk about them. But what I'm talking about are non-uniform plasma, and this is the result, once again, of the solar wind, primarily, and causing all kinds of disorder in the plasma. I also talk about around Earth, for example, there are 17 local electrical batteries. These are batteries that form in the plasma because of the turbulence of this solar wind flow by Earth, the discharge of the solar capacitor, and it just creates, it creates batteries. And I'll give you a very simple one. One of the main ones is when the solar wind is coming out towards Earth or one of the big planets with a magnetic field. It starts to sense that magnetic field, and the electrons go one way because they're bending in the magnetic field. And then the protons go the other way, and the ions, positively charged ions, they all go the other way. And so what happens here? You have a separation of charge. Well, that's a battery. So that's a very good example. So this surrounds Earth as this flow, negative on one side, positive on the other side, flows around Earth. And all of a sudden now, let's say you get a solar surge where the solar wind comes all of a sudden at much higher velocity, and it compresses that battery. Well, that's a rapid change, and that rapid change can then be felt all the way down into the troposphere, which is where we experience weather. The troposphere is basically when you look up, the clouds that you see, etc., are in the troposphere. That's where our weather, our jet streams, our wind systems, the hurricanes, the tornadoes, the snowstorms, everything, where they come from. Okay, so basically what this is saying is that in the non-uniform plasma, which surrounds our Earth and is in our solar system, near-Earth space, we're talking about the near-Earth space environment, and ionosphere to troposphere responses. In other words, our weather is driven by the currents that are flowing around Earth, and the ionosphere is a charged layer up at the upper layers of the Earth's atmosphere. These electrical currents then drive down through the atmosphere, causing lightning, weather, winds. Everything you experience in weather comes from this energy source. And oddly enough, not oddly enough, but very bizarrely enough, modern meteorology does not even know about this. They don't even talk about this. So here I am in an international meeting introducing this as the primary source of energy for weather, for Earth weather. And so I'll just read a couple lines here from this abstract. It's about probably about a good 5-minute read if you read it all the way through, but I don't want to put you to sleep. I'll just read a few lines out of this. And this is to give you an idea of what I present at international meetings. Most Earth weather and ionosphere space environment coupling studies separate the problems into distinct groups. And then I describe those groups, the different layers of the atmosphere, etc. And then I say, the theoretical work here shows that not only are these areas coupled and related, but it also shows that without the constant electrical and resulting magnetic driving forces from space environments, Earth would have little, if no, weather variability at all below the ionosphere. Okay, so anyway, what I'm doing is I'm taking standard meteorology and just saying it does not exist, it does not have any validity at all. Then reading on below, with only solar light energy as input, Earth and the other planets would have little weather at all. Okay, and then farther below, the source of energy comes from localized plasma discharging of a non-uniform plasma environment that powers the electrical systems of the entire solar system. Okay, then I talk about the connection is made theoretically with the solar wind that drives the 17 identified local electrical batteries. And so also it says these are ultimately the source of electrical energy that power the severe lower atmospheric storm systems, such as westerly moving hurricanes at low latitudes and associated tornadoes. And so you get the idea. What I'm doing here is I'm taking standard theoretical meteorology and just basically saying it's not valid, and then replacing it with a complete breakdown from everything from the sun's fusion, where the electric charging first begins, the entire process of building up the non-uniform plasmas in the solar system, the Earth discharging that. And then ultimately at the bottom, I conclude by saying a connection is made between these energy sources and cyclonic storms, earthquakes, and volcanic trigger mechanisms. The goal of this research is to create an overall space weather model that couples the single energy source, which is the non-uniform plasma environment of the sun created by an excess current of positive charge in the solar wind. Now that's a mouthful, I'm sorry, but... And then the goal of this research is to create an overall space weather model that couples the single energy source to the Earth's magnetosphere and ionosphere, and ultimately to the low altitude weather systems. Okay, so this is decades later, really, from the work that was done with the Russian scientist. So here I am many, many years later, more than a decade later, still presenting this material, and the meteorological community is completely oblivious to understanding the true nature of the solar system and especially the causes of weather. And okay, so jumping on to another article here. Now this is another abstract. Presented at American Geophysical Union meeting. Sources of EMF, in other words, sources of voltages, electromagnetic fields, sources of EMF in near-Earth and planetary environments. Okay, so here I'm once again talking about the local electrical batteries. The same information presented from a different point of view. Where I'm talking about, I'm getting right down to the batteries and I'm showing how they form. What's the plasma environment that causes these batteries to form? And then how does it affect planetary environments? So it starts out in the abstract, says, the realization that extensive electrical activities occur in and above the troposphere, extending into the ionosphere and ultimately coupling to the magnetosphere, has raised the theoretical and experimental questions regarding the sources of EMF, which create the observed effects. Okay, so then I go on talking about the 17 local electrical batteries. It goes on to say, energy flows also occur in the vortex regions, corresponding to troposphere low-pressure cells, as the easterly flowing ionosphere high-latitude belts interact with the equatorial westerly moving streams. And so if just to explain this a little bit, on Earth you have five belts which are coupled. These are electrical charged currents. You have two up at the poles and they move in the same direction. Then you have the mid-latitude, the main easterly moving current sheets, and then at the equator you have a westerly moving electron current sheet. The positive flow is from ions and the equatorial stream is from electrons, and these couple together. If you look at Jupiter has 13 bands and they're rotating in opposite directions. Bands that are right next to each other are rotating in opposite directions around the planet. And this is an electromagnetic coupling, and it separates the positive from the negative charges, etc., But anyway, if you are in the environment of Jupiter, you would have an extremely dynamic situation with local electrical batteries, certainly much more complex than Earth. In fact, that would be another very good follow-on, another follow-on study. Okay, on to the next one. X-ray production and discharges of non-uniform plasmas. Okay, here we are again, non-uniform plasmas. What's so special about them? Because uniform plasmas, you do not get discharging because there's no non-uniformity to cause the electrical currents to flow. Just putting a neutral object there does not, it comes in with the same electrical potential as the plasma if it's a uniform plasma. So once again, you have to understand the non-uniform plasma case, and nobody did. Nobody understood where this came from or what caused it, because non-uniform plasmas do not last long in outer space. They last a New York second or less, if they exist. So there has to be something there that causes them to exist and maintain over long periods of time. And so anyway, this particular session, I presented it talking about X-ray production. And of course, the X-rays in comets had already been discovered. I had predicted them in my original three-part comet paper, which was literally published in the early 1980s, and subsequently that was one of the main predictions that I had made, that you will differentiate the ice ball or the dirty snowball comet model from the plasma discharge comet model because of the X-rays, and they were discovered. And so anyway, I'm not going to go into all of that detail, but here I'll just read a little bit of this abstract talking about X-rays. And of course, I have to talk about comets also. And so from the abstract reading now, new evidence indicates that comets are not dirty snowballs, but are in fact asteroid objects, rocky objects involved in the discharge of the non-uniform local plasma. The complete theory for this model for comet behavior was published in 1979, called the Plasma Discharge Comet Model. But until close-range data was obtained, it has not been recognized. One of the predictions of the model was the sunward side X-ray signature that was an inherent part of the model resulting from the pinched electron stream. Pinched means when the electrical current stream pulls itself together magnetically. So in other words, one of the inherent part of the model resulting from the pinched electron stream coming from the sun side and encountering both the coma material and also the electric field of the negatively charged comet nucleus. This model was presented also in a poster session of the 1997 American Geophysical Union meeting, and you can see that poster on my webpage. It's one of the three posters in my poster set that I sell on the webpage. And then just finishing, it says, this effect is not limited to the environment of comets, but also occurs when any object discharges local or wide-scale non-uniform plasmas. The effect is not limited to X-ray production, and the resulting electromagnetic generation depends on numerous factors. The model and effects will be presented in relation to comets and the more general case. So it's not just comets. It could be planets and other solar system objects, etc., but primarily comets, because they discharge the solar capacitor to a much greater degree. Okay, so I want to cut this off, but I just am giving you an example, as I said, of the paper trail that goes on for decades through the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, and then up now, of course, up into the 2020 decade and certainly beyond. I don't plan on going away. Also, I may as well at this point talk about the rest of the books that are on the homepage that are in the book collection that are publicly available. And the reason being is that these are, once again, a paper trail. But finally, I wrote a book on comets, and this was something that was long overdue. to write a book specifically about comets, because all of the other work literally is a lot of generalization, where the plasma discharge comet model is part of the other work. So anyway, I wrote a book specifically about comets, and interestingly enough, the cover photo is of the Schumacher-Levy 9 comet, which broke apart into 21 pieces and then came into Jupiter. And as the Russian scientists said, this was back in 1994, they said that there's no question that my plasma discharge comet model is correct, and this dirty snowball thing was just bizarro weird at that point, because we had decades of information that it couldn't possibly be true. Then I wrote a book called Water, is the title, and I think it's interesting just to read the subtitles here. Let me just zoom in on this a little bit. It says, this is the science, and once again, I have my water filter company, and being a physicist, I had a lot of experience. I could apply my scientific background to the understanding of water, etc. But I also got a very good inside view of what was going on, and I saw things that a lot of other people would never have seen, would not have known about. For example, George Bush Sr., when he left office, he handed over the baton to his longtime business partner, Billy Clinton. He went up to the Bank of Canada and spent his time sequestering the water rights around the Western Hemisphere. And a lot of people don't know that. And why was he doing that? Because water was one of the most important things on the planet. And if you look also, this is after Clinton's term as president ended. In fact, it was just ending in the year 2000. If you look at the cover of Forbes magazine, I think it was the January 1st issue of Forbes magazine, it said that water in the 21st century would be the, like gold, it would be like oil, it would be the thing that wars were started and fought over, but also that it would became a commodity, something that was owned, where companies would literally go out and make special economic effort to harbor water as a resource. So very important. But anyway, let me just read the cover of this water book. And by the way, I send this out free with every order. This, no matter what people order from the jmccsci.com webpage, they'll get a copy of this water book. So I give it away because it's so vitally important. Anyway, here's the cover text. The science of water is the most misunderstood concept on this amazingly wonderful water planet. From meteorology to earth sciences, misconceptions abound. The control of water on a global scale is devastating the most basic rights of humans, the right to clean, fresh water. Where does water come from? Who owns water? Who should control water? Who permits water pollution? Is access to water a natural right of all? Is there really a water shortage or a global water management problem? What can an individual do? This book proclaims a declaration of water independence for all. What does this mean to the planet? What does this mean to you? And then I have a picture of the globe, a beautiful water planet, in which there's a water shortage. They say, oh, there's a water shortage. But the United States and the developed countries have been polluting the water, and all of this pollution goes into the water table under the ground, and then this is pumped up in the water systems. And that's why, by the way, I sell water filtration systems for the entire house, because you cannot shower in this. I mean, it goes through your skin, it gets into your bloodstream. You have more protection if you drink a glass of water than if you take a shower in it. In a shower, you're breathing in the vapors, etc. But the whole issue is that water is 95% of it, of the fresh water, is locked into the ice caps in Antarctica and in Greenland. And so most of the water that's at the North Pole in the form of ice is underwater, because the North Pole is literally a floating iceberg. There's no land there. It's not like the South Pole where you have a land continent and then the snow is on top of it. So that's why if you melt the North Pole, it's not going to change the sea level hardly at all, because most of it, if you look at an iceberg, most of that iceberg is under the water. If you take a glass of water and you put some ice cubes in it, most of the ice is under the level of the water. And so it's the same way with an ice cube, etc. Or the ice packs that are up for the North Pole. But Greenland, once again, is land, and it has the ice pack on top of it. Now, there have been pole shifts in the last 10,000 years, but Greenland, oddly enough, has remained up inside the Arctic Circle, where it's remained primarily frozen. But then you come along, and then there's this effort called global climate change. And the whole purpose of that political football is to control water. That's all it's ever been. That's all it ever will be. And the people that jump on this bandwagon of global climate change don't understand that the real issue is the control of water. That is the underlying premise. That is what it's all about. And whenever you see an article on climate change, the first thing they talk about, if you look at it closely, is water. They want to control the water. That's pure and simple. So anyway, this book on water is in ebook format, and that's the second purely ebook. All the previous books were available in print form, and now all of them are available in ebook format. The next book is a follow-up to the Calculate Primes book, and it is called, oddly enough, I picked this mnemonics name when I was a kid in first and second grade, maybe first grade. The first books we had were Dick and Jane books, See Dick, See Jane, See Dick and Jane, See Dick Run, See Jane Run, See Dick and Jane Run. And so anyway, anybody that's a bit older probably saw those or used those books in first grade. And so there was the very front cover of that book is Fun with Dick and Jane, of course, in English. So what I did is I made a mnemonic similarity title between Fun with Dick and Jane, but I spelled fun, P-H-U-N, I spelled with, W-I-T-H, just like with. And then I spelled Dick as D-I-K, and then Jane as J-A-Y-N. So Fun with Dick and Jane. But the true title is Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. And the reason I did this is because whenever I came out with a book, the CIA trolls would come out with another book with a very similar title and try and prevent people from getting to my work, basically. So that's why I did that, to make it kind of so ridiculous. If somebody tried to copy the title, that it would be just more than apparent, and it would be very hard to do. And so, but the real title of the book is Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. And some of you may be asking, what's an RSA code? Well, remember that I am a specialist by trade, 25 years in the telecommunications industry with encryption, computer protocols, transmission protocols, firewalls, computer security, etc. And so anyway, in my 2007 book, Calculate Primes, I stated that I broke the RSA codes. And so finally, I wrote a book that showed exactly how to break the codes. And using my Calculate Primes generator function, that directly calculates prime numbers in groups. And so this book also talks about the absolute corruption in the spying world with the NSA, with the CIA spying on everybody, gathering information and using it as a political weapon to eliminate people who would have political clout or could raise political clout, and then putting all of the effort into one certain political party, and that's where it is today. You have the political party that's funded and backed by the CIA, which is the police force of the World Bank, and then you have everybody else. It was important to expose the fact that the encryption systems, especially the ones that they're using for private computer systems, like the computers that you use, that to show that those encryption systems and firewall systems are broken. They can get into your computer anytime they want to see all your emails, see who you're writing to, see what you're writing about. And this is getting to the point where they can examine it with AI. Then if red flags come up, then they ship it off to a real person that works in these computer centers that do nothing all day except examine what the public is talking about and what they're communicating about with their friends. Okay, so that's the next book in this series. Now, the next book is something that is so afield from everything else that I had done. It's the Mekani Wing Generator. The Wing Generator is a very high-efficiency wind energy device that has 25 improvements over the three-blade monsters that dot the countryside. When you look through the countryside, or if you see, say, some ad, somebody's going to save the world with green energy, a lot of times they'll put up a diagram or a picture of a three-blade wind turbine or a whole field of them. And they're really obnoxious. They're obnoxious. The three-blade wind turbines are terribly obnoxious, and they will never, ever in a million years solve our energy problem. So what I did is this goes back into the 2000s. I invented a very efficient wind energy system, and as I said, had 25 improvements over the three-blade wind turbines. And just to give you an idea of the three-blade wind turbines, the wind blows through them in a 30-mile-an-hour wind, which should be maximum energy production for a three-blade wind turbine. That's where they peak out. 97% of the wind never touches the blades. And so it's absolutely absurd. The wind just blows right through them. And they spin very slow. They're just, these big ones that you see in the countryside are just horrific. They don't produce energy at all. One time I was driving out in California. I was coming up to the Bay Area. I was driving in from the east. And I stopped off at a fruit stand. And down the road was this big three-blade wind turbine. It was just sitting there still. And the wind was blowing like crazy. So I said to the fruit stand lady, I said, the wind generator up there with all this wind, it should be producing energy. And she goes, no, that thing never spins. She said, that thing's been there for a long, long time. It doesn't ever do anything. And so the end result was that they're being paid not to produce electricity. And the more they install, the worse it gets. So anyway, I invented a system that would literally solve the world energy problem, and that was my main criteria, was to design a wind energy system that could be scaled up to very large sizes. And that was the ultimate goal, so that you could make them big enough to replace nuclear and coal power plants. Now, the other topic that I breach in this book is called The Myth of Alternative Energy. And this is something that I realized from a physics point of view in the early 2000s. And the history of this book is something like this. I was working in the Twin Cities, and I had a friend who was working for an alternative energy company. And I got to know them, and I was looking into this whole issue of alternative energy, etc. And the company that he worked for, they were making biofuel. So at any rate, they asked me as a project to do an energy analysis of the local electric company, which was called Xcel Energy. They cover, I think, like a 10 or 14 state region of the upper Midwest, and they were really going to invest in three-blade wind turbines, some solar not so much solar, but mainly the three-blade wind turbines, because there was a region in southwestern Minnesota called Buffalo Ridge, and it was where the wind would come off the western plains, and it would be pressurized because of this ridge. Is a big, I imagine it was like a volcanic rift or something like that in the surface of the earth. But this, and I've been there in person, it's a rocky area, and anyway, the wind from the west would come up and become pressurized, so it was a very high wind area, and they wanted to exploit this to put in three-blade wind turbines and generate electricity and be one of the first people to be so-called green. And so anyway, I did an analysis of the coal-burning fire plants, and then also Xcel Energy has two nuclear power plants there, and to see what the long-term effect would be, and also just the efficiency, how much energy is burned, how much coal is burned, how much nuclear fuel is burned to create the electricity. And once the electricity is generated, how much of that actually gets to the users to make toast or light a light bulb or whatever. And so anyway, I did this energy analysis. And at the end of the study, they said, we want you to check out three-blade wind turbines, which were just beginning to be commercialized at that time on a wider scale in actual real numbers, and then also solar. And what I realized, and now just remember, this is in around the year 2000 and probably 2004, something like that, maybe even a little bit earlier. But what I realized is, number one, solar panels would never, ever work. And so anyway, this whole study brought me to a topic called The Myth of Alternative Energy. And when I wrote this book, the book was published, I believe, first in about 2009, 2010 time frame. And also I did some radio shows. I remember being on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, the host of Coast to Coast AM. And I did a show specifically entitled The Myth of Alternative Energy, where I exposed this whole alternative energy industry as a basically corrupt industry, an industry that really had no product but was going to milk the American public until the cows came home. And then I also pointed out that General Electric in the United States and Siemens in Germany were the two primary developers of wind turbine technology, and they bought up a lot of little companies on the way to get rid of them. But it just turned out that GE and Siemens happened to have their main core business in the central power companies, making the big turbines, making the and the support that went with it, the maintenance contracts, etc. And so they were moving also into the new natural gas generators that were, they were like a jet engine where they had a two-phase electrical generation. They used the first stage to generate electricity from turning the blades. And then the second stage was a heat conversion. So it was a two-stage electrical generator. But that was GE and Siemens, both of their core businesses. So why would they develop a product that would replace all of this and make the standard electrical generation from coal, natural gas, and nuclear would make it obsolete? Why would they do that? Well, it did not make any sense at all. But of course, what I found out was that the three-blade wind turbines and solar would not work. And very simply, when you take solar, the sun only shines a few hours of the day. And when it's cloudy out, the solar production goes to zero. And even if you had a beautiful sunny area like Phoenix, which would be maximum production in solar energy, what do you do during the nighttime? All those nighttime hours with all those air conditioners running, etc. And I did some studies, like for Los Angeles, for example. If you wanted to just run the air conditioners of Los Angeles on a summer day, you would have to pave the entire city. You would have to cover the entire city with solar panels. And that would not include the cost of the batteries. And the cost of this would be around $1 trillion. And so it's not even feasible. And then I said, okay, what if you took a solar panel, and you could invent a solar panel, and this is you do as a physicist. Sometimes you take it to the extreme case of the parameters, etc. And so what if you could invent a solar panel that was 100% efficient? Now, the typical solar panel today is running maybe around 20% efficiency. In other words, 20% of the sunlight that hits it is converted into electricity. So what if you could increase that by a factor of 5 and make it 100% efficient? Okay, now you could have a solar panel that would be really amazing. But and what if you could make that solar panel that would cost 1 penny each? And so instead of, you know, maybe $600 to $1,000 for a solar panel, you would now have a solar panel. I'm talking commercial grade solar panels, not the little ones you buy at your house. But I'm talking about commercial grade solar panels. But what if you could build that for 1 penny a piece? A penny a piece, 100% efficient. And I would even throw in, you know, it would work when there's no clouds in the sky. Or when there were clouds in the sky, it would still work. What if you could have all of this in a solar panel? And would it still solve the world energy problem? And the answer is no. It wouldn't. Because you need batteries. You need to store the energy. Now you're going to say you have maybe 6 to 8 solar hours per day. That would be the equivalent number of hours where the solar panels are producing 100%. And remember that the solar panels don't always point directly at the sun. They're off at an angle. So if you had this entire southwest desert paved with solar panels, it still wouldn't solve the world energy problem, because what do you do at night? As soon as the sun goes down, you don't have any energy at all, ever. There's no way to cure that problem. So solar, if you look at it, really peel back all the onion layers, solar will not work. And if you see the big solar markets, they're in California, they're in Arizona, and they put some solar panels on somebody's house and give them the really improbable promise that they're going to save money on their electric bill, get them to sign a contract, put them on the house. And so anyway, I won't go into that whole industry, but the end result is when you take the single criteria, will it solve the world energy problem? The answer is no. It won't ever cure this world energy problem. It won't even come close to it. And in fact, it won't even cover the growth of electric use as we move into the future. Okay, so now you're left, solar isn't going to work. What about wind? Well, it turns out that wind is a very good energy resource because it blows day and night. It blows at the North Pole, at the South Pole, every place in between. If it's raining, the wind is still blowing. And then some people say, well, sometimes the wind is not going to blow. So do you watch? You can't watch TV at night. Here's the issue. If you look at the national wind average, this is time averaged over the entire United States, the amount of wind energy is a constant. And so if it's not blowing in New York, it's blowing in Los Angeles. If it's not blowing in Los Angeles, it's blowing in Seattle. If it's not blowing in Seattle, it's blowing in Oklahoma, in West Texas. There are regions of the country that we know are very high wind production. And so back to Xcel Energy, with all of the tens of thousands of wind turbines that they installed, they never really got much energy out of them. It was a big boondoggle. And once again, this whole industry is corrupt. So it brings up the topic, the myth of alternative energy. And so what I invented, now the wing generator, fast forward to today, 2022, there are 2 patents issued on the wing generator covering the patented design of the wing, etc. And so anyway, this was a monumental effort. And then I took this, and I'm jumping too far in the future. I just want to talk about these books. I'll talk about some of the other accomplishments. I was just going to mention that I entered an X Prize and was a finalist out of 98 international teams using the wing generator. But I'll talk about that in the future. Once again, doing something totally devoid of my work, with the electrical nature of the solar system, totally devoid of the prime numbers, completely different, something completely different, and judged by an international group of judges, and using the wing generator technology. Okay, so at any rate, that book, published in around 2010, a very important contribution. And of course, I have a rule that when you see articles in the newspaper, you see these things like this balloon that flips back and forth in the air and it supposedly creates electricity. The things you see that are publicized, or how about the big metal tanks, you take it out to the middle of the ocean in the North Sea where there are waves and it bobs up and down and creates electricity. My rule of thumb is that if you see it in the news, if it gets funding, it's not going to work. And why is that? Because the big international financed people, the people with big money, are heavily invested in standard energy production. As simple as that. And so how could it be that a patented device that has 25 improvements over the current technology cannot break into this realm of alternative energy when it's desperately needed? And the answer is nobody at that level cares. It's just like in the science industry. Nobody cares. All people care about is maintaining the status quo. So the wing generator is something, I'll be talking more about that and some of the accomplishments, etc., of the wing generator. But once again, it is scalable. It can be scaled up to very large sizes. Okay, on to the next. Now, this is actually not really a book. It's a white paper. It was released on December 31st, 2015, and it came from a visit. I was in Peru. I was doing a tour of Peru. I flew to Lima, rented a car, which is an experience all by itself in Peru. It's not like renting a car in the United States. There are not many rental cars in Peru, even in Lima, the capital. So anyway, I rented a car and drove for 3,000 kilometers. And I went to Cusco, I went to Machu Picchu, I went to Lake Titicaca, I went down the coastline to Bolivia and down to the coastline, the western coast, and drove the coast highway all the way back to Lima. And so in the midst of this trip, I stopped off at the Nazca Plains, the Nazca Pampa region of Peru. And it's a elevated desert region that's one of the driest areas in the world. And of course, there are the famous Nazca lines. And these are lines that are drawn in the desert where they move the rocks out of the way and made troughs. And made these figures like monkeys and whales and seaweed and spirals, etc. And nobody's ever really understood what these were for. And so what I did is when I was there, I really didn't go to study these. I just happened to be there as a tourist. And then I came back to them a few days later when I had time to study and look at the aerial photography and the satellite photography of the area, etc. And then the day I went back there, I went up to the mounds that are there. I wouldn't say they're man-made. We don't know who made these. But getting up on the top of this mound, I could feel the atmospheric electricity, and I saw the lines coming back from all of these figures to these mounds. And I said, I'm standing in the center of an electrical circuit. These are electrical circuits. And I realized, too, from my experience with antennas, etc., from my telecommunications experience, that these were an antenna complex, but using a type of antenna that had not even been discovered until recently, within the last 10 years, of modern antenna design called a fractal antenna. And so anyway, I just want to mention this briefly because I'm going to go into this in a lot more detail, because it's so very important in the development of our understanding of man. Because here you have primitive, possibly 5 or 10,000-year-old entities. We don't know anything about who built these. They were not built by the Incas. But the Nazca lines are huge antenna complexes that span the desert in Peru. And I also discovered how they were powered with the atmospheric electricity, because that's something I just happen to be an expert in also. So at any rate, quickly mentioning that. And then the next book is one of the first of a three-set book on prime numbers called Principles of Prime Numbers. And I'll talk more about these books in the future. And then the very last book is called Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. And that book, I lay out the entire history of the Harrington search for Planet X, the discovery, Tom Van Flandern being involved, the death of Harrington, the cover-up with the CIA, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration covering this up, the sequestering of people in NASA, having them sign gag orders, etc., and that whole story of how Planet X was really the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, and that's what Harrington had discovered. I talk about that. A very important book in that entire sequence, in that entire crazy history, which I've talked about. And of course, my work was central to all of it because it had to do with comets and planets and comets becoming planets and the amazing efforts of the intelligence agencies to prevent the public from knowing about this. And so anyway, I'll quick read the cover phrases here. Past decades were filled with disinformation planted by the CIA, who took over NASA in 1991. False characters were created, disseminating complete fabrications to lead the public astray. Behind it all was something that came and went in the night. NASA hid data while discussing this in closed meetings. How many Planet X objects have been discovered? Why did this happen? What were they afraid of? And what is the real history of Planet X? So at any rate, a very important time in this whole entourage of just extremely bizarre behavior by the intelligence communities, keeping the public from understanding what was going on. Okay, so now I've quickly summarized the entire book set. These are the books, and there's more to come. There are more books on the drawing board here. There's two more prime number books which are on the drawing board, ready to be released, etc. And the three-part series of The Principles of Prime Numbers, very important work dealing with that mathematical topic. And once again, I'm running out of time here, but I will be back next week in this year-long series of History of Discovery, my works. Remember the web pages, jmccwaterfilters.com and jmccsci.com. Once again, this is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.